The switching power supply is less tolerant to the feedback voltage from the battery, the big tank filled with chemicals and anode cathode plates. So that is I've seen many times that it's 2-3 days and power supply, switching power supply is done. And that's why it's the main reason why people go with linear power supplies. But also in audio industry, anything with mixers whatsoever, I never saw any, just one single device that has a switching power supply. Enter here.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing what's going on the 75 meter band with these e-rigs. And what I mean by E is class E operation. As a footnote, I'm just adding that in because amplifiers are rated as per their service that they give. And there's class A, class B, class C, and so on. And we've all learned these when we were taking our amateur exam. They would give a class C amplifier and how that's used, and a class A amplifier, and so on. And I can talk a little bit about that, but that's another topic. Basically, what they're doing now is they're using amplifiers that are in the class D and class E mode, which is basically a switching supply. Supply meaning supply of RF voltage. So your transmitter is a class E transmitter. They started with class D, then they went to E, and maybe they'll go to F and G and so on. But it's a switching type of transmitter that's different from any other design that's out there. I have some schematics of it, but it gets a little bit complicated to explain. And the only reason why I'm saying that is because, listen, you're talking about batteries and charging and so on. Yeah, linear supplies have their purpose, but switching supplies is what I see. I'm using one right now, even to power this radio. I'm using an Astron, and it's a switcher, and it puts out up to, this one says 15 amps. Actually, this one says up to 30 amps. I'm reading the wrong meter. This one can produce 30 amps of current at 15 volts, and it's very small. It's only a couple of inches wide. Okay, I gotta remember not to time it out. So, anyways, what I started to say, and I'm not expecting people to do this, if you ever want to troubleshoot a switching supply, it's a good challenge, because there could be things that, many things that go wrong. Most of the time, when I've troubleshot these power supplies, it's usually a capacitor that goes bad, and it's usually in the switching circuit. The switching circuit itself could be rather complex. It could use discrete components, it could use an integrated circuit, or a combination of both. And sometimes you have to know what components are doing what. And of course you have to have the schematic, and you have to know how to read the schematic and follow it. So, and this is the basic troubleshooting, you need that anyway. You need a schematic, and as I mentioned in the past, in troubleshooting techniques, that's a skill that, has to be learned over time. Just by rolling up your sleeves and digging in. If you have a radio that doesn't work, then of course, as I mentioned before, you gotta know what the radio is supposed to do and what it's not doing. So, in switching or any kind of power supply, it's pretty simple because the power supply is supposed to put out a certain voltage at a certain current, and you can measure that with either a voltmeter, a current meter, or both. And there are on the market electronic loads that are used for checking power supplies. By the way, an electronic load is basically a variable load. That's what they call electronic, which you can adjust to dissipate a certain amount of current from a certain power supply for checking the power supply's performance. And that's only, it's basically a static test, you know, it's just measuring the voltage and current. If you want to go deeper into it, which was mentioned, Roy mentioned earlier, because of the switching speed, it produces a frequency of that speed, and the question is, how clean is that frequency? Obviously, if it's if the frequency of the switching transistor, which switches, if the waveform of that is not correct, you could be producing harmonics all over the place, and of course you wouldn't know it unless you turn on a local receiver and hear, you know, interference from the supply, which is not uncommon. So what they, what manufacturers have done over time is they've cleaned up the supplies by filtering and rounding off the edges of the switching transistor waveform that switches it. Instead of it being a square wave, it's a modified sine wave. There's all different types that I've seen on the market. But as far as troubleshooting, the main thing that I want to get across is where to connect some test equipment so you can see what's going on. You see, the problem is because the AC line voltage is going directly, in most cases, to a couple of diodes, which most of the time is in a full wave configuration. And full wave means the type of rectifier that they're using is half wave, is full wave, and so on. One side of that line is the return for measuring that voltage, that DC voltage. So because of that, if you connect your ground, if you have a oscilloscope probe and connect it across that rectified line, you're going to cause some damage. And that's, it may not be obvious at first, but you just have to keep that in mind. So the bottom line to that is whenever you, and again, I don't expect anybody to do this, because you need the equipment. When if you're ever going to troubleshoot a switching supply and go probing it, other than using just a regular multimeter, you need an isolation transformer. And an isolation transformer is basically is what it says. It's a transformer with a 1-to-1 ratio, so it isolates the line from the switching power supply itself. And through that, now you can ground, because your ground of your oscilloscope probe will be isolated from one side of the line. Maybe a little bit hard to understand that what I'm saying, but that's the case in unless it has some other isolation built into the supply. But most of the time, you need an isolation transformer. I happen to have Sencor is a company that made a lot of nice test equipment, and one of the pieces that I have is it's a variable AC supply that isolates the line automatically. It's like a variac, only it's more isolated and also gives you other features like a digital display, and it'll actually tell you how much current it's drawing from the line, because that could be another clue. So basically, in a switching supply, there are two returns or grounds. I'm gonna say going to call it a return because it's not really ground. You have your primary, which is your line side return, but then you have your switching side return, which is the negative side of the DC supply, and that's after it's re-rectified back to a voltage and current of the supply. So in other words, it takes, you're taking the line, you're rectifying it, putting it into a switching circuit, which is DC. Switching circuit switches a transformer or an inductor of some type. It could be a buck boost, which is the name for it. And that produces a voltage, which is now rectified back to DC, and that's how you get the DC output, basically, in a very simple form. All right. By the way, I wasn't planning on talking about switching supplies tonight. I was talking about transmitters or oscillators or something. The last time I mentioned troubleshooting, I was talking about microphones and signals that go into an amplifier. But then again, you have to, you guys are going to go in digging into your own equipment. It's great. It's great to do because you can learn about it, but you need some equipment to do just that and to understand what's going on and schematic block diagrams. Especially block diagrams are very useful because they isolate, different parts of the circuit and blocks so you can see, what's going on. There's many YouTube videos that I've seen on this stuff. It's all over the place. If you ever want to do this, and they probably explain it better than me, or just on the radio. they go into more detail than they actually show. I think a hands-on thing is always nice to have. A hands-on class where you're given, a piece of equipment, and here, try to figure it out. What's wrong with it? What is it not doing? And what is it supposed to do that it's not doing? And so on. Maybe even a Zoom meeting is good for that. You could have a little class on that. But right now, all we're doing is, conveying information on the air, and it's a little bit harder to do, especially troubleshooting. The way I learned is the way I'm describing, by just digging into it and at least understanding the schematics as a start, and then trying to figure out, from there what's happening. Stencor also makes a piece of equipment which I've used. It's used in troubleshooting TV sets, but I've come up with a way of adapting it to switching power supplies because it's basically a horizontal oscillator analyzer. What I mean by horizontal, that's the horizontal scan in your TV set. And it's used to measure the horizontal circuit in a TV. But we don't use these anymore because this goes back to the tube days and solid state when TVs had separate horizontal oscillators and vertical oscillators and everything else. Nowadays, that's all changed. So I bought this equipment for troubleshooting computer monitors, actually, because the older CRT monitors had just that, had what they call a flyback transformer, which produced high voltage. It had a vertical oscillator, horizontal oscillator, and of course frequencies were a lot different than your standard TV because your definition from your computer monitor is whatever speed the monitor is set for and it's adjustable, which is determined by the computer, by the video card in the computer. So the, you know, the refresh rate and so on. Anyway, so this piece of equipment was designed along with a computer monitor tester itself to troubleshoot computer monitors. The computer monitor tester, which I also have, by the way, produces different rasters, which is different waveforms for checking the computer monitor performance in either a VGA, EGA, or CGA format. Of course, now we're using HDMI and everything else, but my old IBM computer uses a color monitor, which has a CGA, I think it's a CGA, or EGA port, which is like a, you know, a DB9, it looks like a DB9 connector. Anyway, so this equipment is used for that, but I've learned that I can also use it for troubleshooting switching power supplies, and it works quite well. These pieces of equipment, by the way, were going for $2,500 and up. That's $2,500 or more from the manufacturer, from Sencor. They were quite expensive. Sencor did have expensive equipment, but nowadays, because computer monitor technologies have changed and TVs have changed, you could find these things on eBay. There was one for sale for $25. That's right, $25, 25 bucks. Where back in the 1990s, you would spend $2,500 rather than $25. You could find this stuff, it's there. If I looked it up right now, I'd probably find a bunch of them. And that's called the HA2500. That's the model number of this horizontal analyzer tester that Sencor makes. And it's great for switching power supplies because the switching frequency can be adjusted. There's a knob right on the front panel, and you can actually change the switching speed. So you can make it compatible with the power supply that you're testing. Okay, basically the way it works, to simplify it, let's say you have a switching power supply that blows fuses, which could be a common problem. And it is a common problem. If your switching transistor shorts out, you're going to blow a fuse. Hopefully. And I'm talking about the fuse in the power supply itself, because it should be protected. Because you're going to be drawing a lot of current on your primary side of your power transformer. That primary side has to see a switching frequency in order to stimulate an AC signal going into your primary. But if your transistor is shorted out, you're going to be taking that voltage and just shorting it to ground, which means you're going to be blowing a fuse on the primary side. That's the rectified side of the line. What this unit does, it actually substitutes the transistor itself. You can remove the transistor, pull it out of the circuit, and replace it with three wires coming from this HA2500 tester. That'll simulate the transistor. It's got this transistor, or any type of transistor that's used, built in to this analyzer, and is configurable and adjustable. So you can adjust the frequency, you can configure it to do different things. It's got a digital display. It'll actually tell you how much current is being drawn through the transistor, and so on. So, if you suspect the transistor is bad, because it's blowing a fuse, and if it blows a fuse and replace the fuse and it blows again, well, then don't replace any more fuses. You got to figure out what's wrong. And if you see your switching transistor is bad, you can substitute it with this unit and then turn it back on. However, there is protection that's built in because they were very clever in their design. And I'm talking about Sencor when they designed this this unit. It's designed to operate on 1/10 the voltage. So you could substitute. Gets a little bit complicated in how to describe it, but you could substitute the bare transistor with the one that's in the unit, and your voltages will be produced, but at a much reduced voltage. And you will switch. It will switch on and off. It will switch the switching transformer. I know that because I've done that. But because it's got current and voltage limiting built in, it's designed not to damage the circuit, not to damage the switching supply that you're going to test. So they reduce the current down to 1/10, they reduce the current and voltage down to 1/10 of its normal value. Yes, thereby, you know, protecting the supply itself, and then you could, and then from there, you could see if there was a problem in the switching circuit or the problem in the output, the switching transistor itself, or somewhere else, which could be on the other side of the rectified voltage, which could be also, you could have a short on the DC side of the supply. And the HA2500 has other leads that you could place on the output of the switching power supply, and you can actually see what the voltage is. It'll be a reduced voltage. You can measure its current. It's got a built-in load that's adjustable, and so on. It's a very nice piece of equipment, and for the price, the price you can get them. I bought mine new, and I paid a lot, but now you can get them so cheap. Very good to have. Of course, there's a couple of things you have to know. If you're going to operate it properly, you have to know the switching speed of your power supply that you're going to be testing, which may or may not be in your operating manual, owner's manual of your supply that you're using. Most of the time, they do give you that spec. They'll give you the switching frequency. And then you can adjust this piece of equipment to match that frequency on its own digital display. All right, so there's a little bit of troubleshooting. Without going into all the intricate circuitry, because it's intricate. You know, there's a lot of stuff that they're squeezing into these supplies. And by the way, as a footnote, something that to keep in mind, I've not done this, but if you notice over time, people are throwing out computers left and right. You've seen tower computers on the street. You've seen laptops on the street, and so on. Every computer has a built-in supply. And those supplies are switching supplies, every one of them. There is no linear supply in a computer. A tower computer always has a switching supply that's producing many different voltages, plus or minus voltages, 5 volts, 12 volts, plus or minus 5, plus or minus 12, and even a few others that are used for the computer. And they produce a lot of current, and there's no reason why you can't use one of them to power up your radio if you wanted to. Of course, I don't know if how clean they are as far as producing other frequencies. I would imagine they would be because it's in the computer itself, and you don't want to get interference from its own power supply. I had my power supply in my lap, my desktop computer, my tower computer, a capacitor actually exploded. It was my fault because the fan and most of these supplies, as you probably know, I'm sure Craig probably knows this, computers have fans built in, and the power supply itself has a fan, the computer has a fan, and sometimes they have two fans in the supply to keep them cool. And in my case, the fan went out. And I knew that. It was just the fan stopped working. It was just, for whatever reason, the motor just stopped working. But I never bothered replacing it, replacing the supply. And I said to myself, I'm just going to keep on using it until it finally cuts out, which it eventually did, because it was getting pretty hot. And it was getting pretty hot for a long time because the fan was not doing its job. So fans are important to keep things cool. I turned on the computer because I don't leave it on all the time, and I heard a loud noise and I saw smoke, and I said, probably one of the filter caps went bad, but no, it wasn't that. It was actually the switching transistor exploded. The whole transistor. There were little bits and pieces of it all over the place. But I went over to Micro Center, and for $30, I bought myself another supply. They had the exact replacement. $30. That's it. So don't try this at home. If your fan goes out in your computer or supply, you know, make sure you replace it. Replace the supply or the fan if you can do that. Yeah. Anyway, so because of the price, you know, it's really not worth fixing these things because they're so cheap. The Astron supplies, the ones that we use to power our rigs, you know, they're a little bit more pricey. And, you know, I would say they're worth fixing rather than throwing them out. The computer supplies, no, not really, in my opinion. You know, they're a dime a dozen. And you could probably go garbage picking and find and collect all the computers that are being thrown out every day that people don't use anymore. Steal the supply out of it, and you got yourself a nice supply. And some of these supplies, as I said, produce quite a few amps, 5 amps, sometimes even 10 amps of current, because they have to supply a number of devices that's in the computer. So that's what I have to say about switching supplies without going into all the, you know, the intricacies of the circuitry, because it's not something that I recommend. But if you do want to dig into a supply and figure it out and measure some waveforms, do get an isolation transformer. You can find those on eBay. They're pretty cheap. An isolation transformer is basically it's a one-to-one ratio transformer. Whatever voltage goes in comes out, but you're isolating the line, so you'll be safe. All right. I think I'm going to wrap that up. I have to. I got to take care of some stuff for work. I am going back to work again. It's been a while. And as I mentioned, the next 2 weeks, we've got a couple of things going on. So, Memorial Day weekend is next weekend. It's a 3-day weekend, basically. And, it'll be nice to, get together with people again. Last year we didn't have it. So that's a good thing. Alright, so that's it, Roy, for now. It's 9:30. Normally I'll go to 10, but I do have to take care of something today, so I got to do this. But I didn't want to leave you guys out, at least mentioning that. And then we can get into, later on, some more transmitter or receiver theory. and how to troubleshoot a boat. All right, so thanks. Roy, back to you. W-H-U-C-D-L, and this has been another edition of Andy's Corner. Go ahead.
CDL, CD2LJC saying hello.
Hello to you. How are you?
I just wanted to catch you before you dropped off the air. I know it's been a while. Just finally put the rig back in the car.
Okay, very good. You sound good.
Thanks. Well, hope to catch you again. This is TD2LJC. Peace. Center reach out.
Okay, very good, Keith. Yes. Sorry, I forgot your name. My memory is not as good. I'm getting older. Okay, thanks. Roy, back to you. WHCDL.
Okay, very good. This is AC2GS. Thank you so much, Andy, for this edition of Andy's Corner. Andy's Corner is going on hiatus for a couple of weeks, but I'm sure when you get back, you'll have some fascinating segments about technical repairs and such. So as always, I want to thank you, Andy, for this and the series of Andy's Corners that you've given us.
Okay, my pleasure. Always good.
Okay, very good. So next on my list, if I remember correctly, Paul said that he had a COVID question. So, Paul, what's your question tonight?
Okay. WS2N here. I was wondering about these people, millions of them, that have had COVID. Wondering how long do their antibodies stay in their system? You know, are they running down to get vaccinated like the rest of us? Or, you know what I mean? Is there hesitancy for these people not to go? Do they think they're going to be immune for a year? I wonder if you've heard anything about that before I back to you.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, there's always a degree of hesitancy, unfortunately. The CDC recommends at this point in time that for maximum efficacy, it's still a good idea, even though these people have been infected already, to undergo either the two vaccination of Moderna or Pfizer or the single shot of Johnson & Johnson. There's no hard and fast experimental evidence to suggest how long people are immunologically resistant to a reinfection. So far, in the short haul, reinfection rate has been very, very small, thankfully. Less than 1% of people with it will develop a secondary infection from another variant in the COVID-19 strain. But the CDC continues to request people to take the vaccinations, even though they were infected and it resolved. There is a degree of hesitancy in general. Some people don't want to get shot with anything. Some people are wary of this vaccination because of anti-vaxxers and some political tendencies they might have. But that's the way it shapes up from my understanding at this point in time. Everything is subject to change. You know, if they do a retro study in years to come and see that people who didn't get the booster had no increased incidence of reinfection like the people who were vaccinated, then with 2020 hindsight, they will have decided that the vaccine wasn't required. But at this point, that's what the CDC is suggesting.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that. I kind of thought that. Somebody told me that if they had it, it would last like about 2-3 months. So it didn't make sense not to get the shot. You know, if you had COVID, you know, the antibodies will stay with you not too long. With a vaccine, you know, you might get 6 months or a year or something. They still don't know. So, of course, you're better off with the vaccine, which is, you know, that's what I thought. Now, what about testing? go down for a COVID test, for instance. What are they testing for you? Fine, if you have COVID, it's going to come up positive. But what are they looking for when you're in your... I mean, suppose somebody goes in there, now I'm 100% vaccinated, but do I come up to them because they see the antibodies in your system? How does that work for you? Back to you.
It depends upon the type of test you're going to take. Most people basically take a cotton swab. That's to see if there are any viral particles being produced in the mucous membrane. So that will indicate an active infection. If they take blood tests, it's possible that they could take antibody titers. But here's where things get unfortunately complicated. Immunity to a virus is not purely an antibody-based phenomena. So it is theoretically possible to have relatively low levels of antibody in your bloodstream and yet be pretty much immune to infection because there's a completely secondary system of killer lymphocytes that get created during the vaccinations and the previous infections. Those are much, much more difficult to test for. So you could have relatively low antibody levels but still be immune to the infection. But primarily, most tests that I've seen are sputum or saliva tests, and they're purely to figure out if a person has an active infection of COVID-19.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that. I just don't hear them talking about this stuff on the radio or the TV, and then not in that kind of detail. Very good. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome, Paul. I have a couple of little puzzler questions, but before I bring them out, if anyone out there has thought up any questions or topics for tonight, they're still open for discussion. You just hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
WB2KWC.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, going along with the COVID topic, I guess, something I've been wondering on the media, they've been saying if you're fully vaccinated, you do not need to wear a mask, or the fully vaccinated do not need to wear a mask. Now, is that also in the presence of folks that are not vaccinated, or is that assuming an environment of 100% fully vaccinated people?
Well, it sort of depends. For sundry bureaucratic reasons, mass transit, you still have to wear a mask. In prisons, nursing homes, hospitals, and other areas where there's ill people collected, you still have to wear the mask. Primarily, the new modification is based upon, thankfully, the research results that show that people who are immune, who are vaccinated, are not likely to be shedders. That was something that concerned people a great deal, that although you were immune to getting the full-fledged infection, you might be an asymptomatic carrier that shed the viruses all around, thus you would infect people who weren't vaccinated, who weren't wearing masks as well. But they found that that's a very minimal, very minuscule figure, so that nowadays, for all intents and purposes, you can associate with people who weren't vaccinated or infected without a mask. Theoretically, they should still wear a mask just to be on the safe side between each other.
Okay. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Ken. Any other questions out there, please just hit the button and give me your first name and call sign.
Yeah,
Okay, nothing heard. Maybe someone will come up with some questions later on. Let's try this new little variation on my puzzlers, which I call stuff I heard on a repeater. This is stuff I did not hear on Limark, but just noodling down the VHF dial, listening into the odd conversation, I picked out a few bon mots from people talking to each other, and I thought I would kind of sling them at you people and see what you say, whether you agree, whether you disagree, whether you have any reasons for agreeing or disagreeing, and we see if it might be a seed for a discussion of some things. So my first stuff I heard on a repeater were these two gentlemen. One was complaining about some problem he was having with his car radio, and he made an offhand comment that he had a couple loops of coax at the floor of his car. The other gentleman responded that, aha, our mutual friend and longtime amateur radio operator cautioned me a few months ago never ever to coil up excess coax that's being used. So in other words, if you have a radio connected to an antenna with coax and it's too long, his belief is that you should absolutely positively never coil it up, but leave it kind of snaked and serpentine. Otherwise, you risk worsening its standing wave ratio. So I would love to have people participate on this tonight. Does anyone agree with this? Does anyone disagree with this? And does anyone have any explanation for this?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I hope the answer is you're allowed to coil it up, because I have all kinds of coils behind my desk for 2 meters for HF, and it better be it's okay. I would imagine it's okay. I have a coil up near the dipole, one of my dipoles, that has I'd say about 9 turns and 8 inches in diameter. I use as a balance. I still get out. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, the so-called ugly balun, a very reasonable thing. You got to be a little bit cautious. It depends upon the type of coax cable you use. You can't make sharp turns with some coaxes, because what happens is the center feed will become distorted and be pushed off center and closer to the shield. But if you keep the loop's diameter reasonable and the cost of the extra length of the coax isn't too much, it makes a agreeable RF a choke. And the method that it uses, of course, is that it applies inductance to the common mode current being reflected back from the antenna. And by increasing the impedance of the common mode, it blocks most of it from returning back to the shack and not giving you common mode interference and having a transmission line acting more like an antenna than as a transmission line. But that poses a question in some people's mind. Looking at the forums on this subject, I saw people write that that's exactly the problem that they perceive, that by looping excessive amounts of coaxial cable, you're adding inductance to your transmission line, which is going to change its standing wave ratio by changing its impedance. Any thoughts on that concept?
WP2EAV.
Yes, and now a word from our engineer. Yes, Ed.
I don't think any of that is justifiable.
Okay, I don't either. The inductance that happens when you coil you do get inductance, but you get inductance for the common mode current, not the differential mode. So it's sort of right but wrong. It's right about something that you want to block and wrong about something you don't want to block. And so ultimately it's complete fables.
The purpose of using a coax is to isolate yourself from any of the things that, like, ladder lines and individual wires are subject to. And this is basically saying you don't get any of the benefits that they make coax to solve.
True. It is based on the fundamental misunderstanding that coaxial cables are electronically shielded devices, unless you bought them in Radio Shack around 1987 for about a year or two when there was barely any outer shielding available on them. But I agree with you entirely. But this apparently is not an uncommon, incorrect belief system among amateur radio operators. There's a lot of it that I can pull up on forums where two groups argue this, and it seems rather obvious, as you feel equally, that it's absurd. You are not going to increase the VISWA. If you have excessive transmission line that you don't need, you might get some degree of attenuation loss. But you'll have that whether you have it serpentined or whether you have it properly coiled around. So as Paul mentioned, it is perfectly fine to coil your wires despite what those guys on their repeater said.
And one more thing. I would be very careful about coiling coax unless it's hidden behind things, like Paul said, because it's a tripping hazard.
Well, agreed. I mean, in general, though, you have to be a little bit aware that you have wire strewn on the ground and kind of try as best you can to not have it be an obstruction or a trap for someone to fall over.
Absolutely. I think we beat that horse to death.
Okay, I've beaten other horses much more into death than this one, but enough of that one. I got one more stuff I heard on repeaters. It's not exactly amateur radio, but I did hear it on a repeater. I'll throw it out to the audience. Guy says to the other guy, I got to go over to my tenant and fix a shower head because it's leaking. So the other guy says, how you planning to fix it? And he says, I think when I put it on originally, I didn't bother putting any plumber's Teflon tape. So I'm going to put some Teflon tape, and that should clear it up. So the other guy said, well, you got to be careful, you know. You can put that stuff on reverse, and then it doesn't work so well. So my other question for tonight is, can you use Teflon plumber's tape in reverse and have it not work out so well?
Headlight 2H?
Yes, Lou.
Absolutely.
Should I explain that? I've been there, done that.
Okay, I think we all have to a degree if we realize what I just said. But please, Ed, tell us your story on it.
The plumber's tape has to be put on that the screw threads don't cause the tape to unravel as you try to tighten it.
VUS2N.
Yes, Paul.
It is right. I spent 30 years doing this. I'm not kidding. So, you put it, you start with the thread near the front. No matter how wide it is, you start near the thread and you follow the thread as if you're gonna go in clockwise direction, like you're making something up. And then when you put the fitting on, it won't back off. It won't tend to back off on you at all. If you go the other way, you'll find it want to back off on you, and you know that's not really a good way to go. Back to your right.
And one other thing, that stuff is cheap enough that if you mess it up, just take it off and slot it in the other direction.
Yeah, I guess so. It's just that when I first kind of heard the way that the guy said it, I imagined things incorrectly for a microsecond. And I thought that there was some story that there is a side of the Teflon tape that belongs on the inner aspect and one on the outer expert portion. And then about a microsecond later, I said he didn't mean the reverse side. He meant the reverse direction. So what he was saying is you have to apply Teflon electrical tape along the thread in a clockwise manner. If you do that, then as you tighten up the other part, it'll stretch on the Teflon tape and everything will work reasonably well. If you reverse it or else apply it counterclockwise, when you then wind the other thing clockwise instead of stretching the tape, you're going to double up and reverse the tape, and it could be a mess. So he was absolutely right. You can apply it in reverse direction, and that will mess up the Teflon tape. And, Teflon tape's relatively cheap, although I've had people tell me that they prefer a particularly thicker version of the Teflon tape. Apparently, they come in different thicknesses, and so they search out the slightly more expensive thickened Teflon tape. So if anyone has any opinion of the thickness of Teflon tape, please feel free.
There is a yellow version of it used for gas fittings, but I have no idea if it's any thicker.
Okay. I mean, I have seen ads for different thicknesses. I think I've only seen two different thicknesses for Teflon plumber's tape. So I know they exist. I don't know if there's a special name for them. I know they cost more, obviously, because they just have more of the material. I think all of us out there have a roll or two of Teflon tape, even people who don't do a heck of a lot of plumbing. Anyway, that's my little experimental stuff I heard on a repeater, and maybe I'll listen a little bit more next week and see if I can come up with a few more. Last week we were discussing, I kind of threw out a recommendation of a science fiction book. Someone else mentioned Andy Weir's excellent book, The Martian. He has a new book out. It's called Project Hail Mary. I'm in the midst of reading it. It's a very reminiscent of The Martian. It's a lot more science fiction in that it's not just visiting Mars, but it's some poor schlep who has to go to a nearby solar system to discover the origins of some extraterrestrial single-celled organism that's slowly eating up our sun and cooling our planet. So if you like The Martian, take a look for it. It's his name is Andy Weir, and the book is called Project Hail Mary.
KG2R1, have a topic.
Yes, David. Yes, David, you have a topic, you said.
Yes, sir. It has three parts. The first part is the answer to Craig's question. If he is able to do all of this internet stuff on those phones with a big battery, then add ham radio apps like and he can stay connected with those things inside the phone that's receiving the phone data. The second part
is what I'm going to drop for a second. Okay, but I did too. I got rid of the signal enhancer noise. Oh, there was some problem. There you are. So I took that out. I took out my MSG. And I put in an Amphenol barrel connector. And put a thorite bead around the coax there. That is 1.1 to 1, very, very good. And then, you know, I want to talk about conditions that we've been having, radio conditions. Last week, and until this Tuesday, there was such a great propagation on 20 meters that people were rag chewing VX. And some of that to South America and the Middle East. It was really very, not only just having some like sporadic propagation. Back to you, Roy.
Well, I mean, that's the nature of amateur radio. It's very erratic and unpredictable. I noticed a decent propagation late in the afternoon, early evening on 20 yesterday. It was about 5, 6 o'clock, and things were really bustling. So there's still a little bit more life in 20 meters. Unfortunately, I have a 10-meter net on Sunday mornings, and there was nothing DX. I don't even think we were able to communicate with people from New Jersey. It was basically Brooklyn and Queens. So 10 meters, not terribly good propagation-wise. 20 has been incredibly better than usual. So when hopefully, as the sunspot activity slowly rises over the next 5-6 years, 20 should be better, and 10 should be great, and 6 should be magical.
QSL. But from Thursday last until this Tuesday, it was... And we were having conversations, you know, 20, 25, 30, you know, and 10 over... Over there, and I was talking to people with very basic equipment, and one person in Austria, 10, and 100 watts in a vertical, you know, which is pretty cool, and some stations, and clear, in the clear, from Kuwait, you know, from New York to Kuwait. You know, it was unbelievable. Just today, Hungary on 17, 10 over 9, for some reason, carrying on a conversation, you know, a short one.
AC2GS. Well, that's good to hear. Again, I don't, unfortunately, can't kind of check the bands every day of the week. Some days are busier than others, but it's nice to know when they're open. If they're open more and more of them open, that would be nicer still. I've noticed some significant improvement from what I've seen in the past on 20 meters. I didn't see the incredible, you know, Kuwait conversations and such at the time that you were listening, because I wasn't on the radio. But it's good to hear, and I mean, that's what we kind of dream of as amateur radio operators. You know, trying to work through the static to hear someone in Pennsylvania is nice, but we'd rather go far distances and have stronger signals available. And like I said, all things being equal, I'm somewhat optimistic about the sunspot cycle. People were terribly pessimistic about 5-6 years ago. They were predicting that the next one will be a complete bust. But I think it'll